chapter 3. Genesis 3:16. Seeing as how we have to believe that Jesus is the Christ, even in order to be saved, we have to know what it meant to John when he said that, which is what we've done the last few weeks. And now I want to touch on what it means to God, or what it meant to God, and the way God revealed this promise. And the reason why is because it just really fascinates me to see how God revealed this, even from the beginning, revealed what his plans were. So notice in Genesis chapter 3, look at verse 15. Let's go ahead and read verse 14. And the Lord God said unto the serpent, because thou hast done this, thou art cursed above all cattle and above every beast of the field. Upon thy belly shalt thou go, and dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Now this is that part of the scriptures where God curses the serpent. And don't get yourself fooled like some people into thinking this is just one of those little snakes that crawls on the ground. The truth is, this serpent was one amazing creature. This happens to be the devil, and he was a serpent, that great serpent, you know, that dragon, or whatever it's called several times in the Bible, Leviathan and such things. This is that serpent. It's not, you know, it's not like this is one of these comic book stories where Eve's talking to a snake. This is a spiritual creature that deceived Eve and reasoned astutely, very, very intelligent. And then God speaks to this serpent, which at that time when this was written and it was all happening, of course, we didn't have the further revelation of who all he was. But this was some creature that God had made, and God cursed him. And God cast him out of his, you know, high exalted position and made him go on the ground. So somehow his appearance changed because he lost certain authorities. He was punished, all of this stuff. But what's amazing to me is right in the middle of his cursing the serpent, even before he cursed the man, even before he cursed the ground, even before he did these other things, he tells that serpent a little prophecy. Just kind of throws in with a few words there. Notice he says, I will put enmity between thee and the woman. Now, I don't know what special enmity there is between the devil and Eve, or the woman, so I'm not going to touch on that. And between thy seed and her seed. Now, seed, of course, meaning progeny, meaning those that come forth from you, your children, your descendants, thy seed. But notice it also says, it shall bruise thy head, meaning her seed shall bruise the serpent's head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Now, just put yourself in the place of the woman and Adam and all the succeeding generations that heard this story, which they all heard it. It was repeated over and over and over again. We have all these curses, and right smack in the middle of the curses, right smack in the middle of the punishment, God says, the woman's seed is going to crush or going to bruise the head of the serpent. And the serpent is going to bruise his heel. Now, the reason why this fascinates me is because, you know, God didn't just come out and say, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. One of the descendants of Eve is going to come, and he's going to be king, and he's going to reign, and he's going to destroy the devil after he suffers and dies and rises again. He didn't just come out and say the whole thing. He, like, gives a little hint. He, like, gives a little clue. Something, you know, to whet the appetite. Something to give a glimmer of hope in the midst of a horrible situation. Just a glimmer of hope. And, of course, the reason why, because God is trying to deal with people on the basis of faith. And he also is weeding out people, those who refuse to believe and those that do believe, those that choose to believe what God has said. So here you have, and this is the only glimmer of hope in this entire thing, where from Eve all the way to Abraham, all these people had to go by was what God had said right there. His heel is going to be bruised by the serpent, but he's going to bruise the head of the serpent. Now, if you're angry with the serpent, which you have every reason to be angry with the serpent, people, the serpent has done us a lot of damage. And I'm not talking about just what he did to Eve, which was a pretty big thing. You know, he caused us a lot of trouble. But if you've got any reason to be upset at the devil, and if you stop and think about it, you ought to have so much reason to be upset at the devil, to be angry that he would deceive, that he would destroy, that he would step in and destroy families and destroy children. And he's such a destructive, miserable creature. And we have every reason to hope for his demise, hope for his judgment, hope for his destruction. And God, right at the beginning, says, this is what's going to happen. But notice it was spoken to the serpent. God made it clear, somebody's coming. Somebody's coming. And he's going to be one of the children of Eve. A human. Somebody is coming, one of the children of Eve, the promised coming Savior, who happens to have his heel bruised. Notice how this fits so perfectly with the other messianic promises and what we know now. But then, set aside for a moment what you know now about the Christ, and think about all of these people that lived from Adam to Abraham, and all they had was this promised seed. Not plural seed, but singular seed. His heel. His heel. Now, think about this from the standpoint of someone truly believing in God. Someone like Noah. Someone like Enoch. Someone who has decided, look, we're going to believe God. We're going to trust God. Well, what do they have to rest on? What do they have to believe in? What do they have to hang on to? Just that. Somebody's coming who's going to beat the devil. Somebody's coming that's going to... And what they could surmise just from this little promise. All the things that they could come up with from this promise. And the fact that he's going to be bruised. There's going to be some setback in his life. There's going to be a fight. There's going to be a war. There's going to be enmity. Wow, something in this promise is deep. Notice that this word of God that was given, passed down from generation to generation during all these times of the patriarchs, and this, they've got this one little promise. There's going to come a seed that's going to destroy the devil. Notice the singularity of that promise. Notice the enmity that's mentioned. Notice the passion that is the suffering of the Christ. Notice the all nations included in that promise too, because he's the seed of the woman. Wow. Also implied are the last days and that salvation. All right, let's move on a little bit farther. Go to Genesis chapter 12. And verse 7. This is intriguing to me, especially because I try to put myself in their situation. Someone like Abraham. Look at chapter 12, verse 7. And the Lord appeared unto Abraham and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. Now that's what the Lord appeared and said to Abraham, unto thy seed. Now, if you were one of the believers during all these years between Adam and Abraham, one of the believers that was resting and hoping on that promise that God had made, that promise of the coming deliverer. So you're waiting for this, and you're grasping at every single possibility. You're trying to figure out how this is going to happen. When is it going to come? You're looking forward to the day that that Savior is going to come and crush that serpent's head. You're waiting for that day. So, then comes God, and he tells Abraham, unto thy seed will I give this land. Well, now Abraham, if he wasn't really thinking about the Messiah, wasn't thinking about this promised one, he would think, and everybody else would think too, if God said, unto thy seed, you'd think, he's talking about my children. In other words, my children are going to be a great nation, they're going to get this land. Oh, wow. And this is a promise just thrown out there to Abram. After all these years, God says, unto thy seed will I give this land. But if you had an inkling that God is promising someone to come, might you not suppose that that word, thy seed, has a cross-reference over there back in Genesis chapter 3? You'd say, wait, maybe he's giving us another promise about the seed. And the reason why I say this is because to me it's clear that that's exactly what happened. It's clear to me that people who were hoping for the Christ, hoping for that promised deliverer, were looking, grasping at any hint or clue of who this promised deliverer is. And the reason why I say that is, I'm sure you know, several times the same phrase is used, maybe 10, 12, 15 times, same phrase, to thy seed I'll give this land, or to thy seed, or unto thy seed. And the reason why I say this, all these times that it's mentioned, and these are the only scriptures they have, just the stories, just that knowledge. Just that knowledge of what God has told them. They don't have the book of Genesis written. Remember this. This was written hundreds of years later by Moses. So they don't have this book of Genesis written. If they do, it's in little small books or small records that they might have and not pulled together as scriptures that they know of. So all they have to go by is this promise that's been faithfully repeated over and over again, and they're hoping for this coming one that God made sure they're hoping for from the beginning. Those who believe, of course. And of course, if you're not one of the kind that's given to spiritual thoughts and wants to know, about God, well, then it's possible you'd just pass right on by it, not notice any promise here at all. In fact, there's a whole bunch of people right now, scholars, people who know a whole lot, that will tell you this is not a messianic promise. None of these are messianic promises. Mean nothing at all of what you're thinking. But those of us who understand the gist of the Bible, we cannot fail to miss it. We're clinging to every word. What does he say? Does he say enmity? Yes, he says enmity. Does he say heal? What could that mean? Heal. Can you see the tantalizing clues God has given? Then he tells Abram, unto thy seed will I give this land. And anybody with an inkling of the promised seed would say, did I hear seed? Did I hear that word seed? Is that what he said? Did he say seed? Yes, he said seed. Did he say seed before? Now, the reason why I'm sure this is what's happening is look at Galatians chapter 3 and verse 16. We have a problem, at least in the eyes of some people. The Bible here has a problem. Paul has a problem. Galatians chapter 3, verse 16. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He saith not, and to seeds as of many, but as of one, and to thy seed, which is Christ. Now what is the problem here? No one ever says seeds to talk about a plural progeny. They just never do. I mean, you look in the Bible all the time, it talks about someone's descendants. They never use the word seeds. So Paul is making a straw man argument saying, well, he didn't say seeds. He said seed, singular. But the word seed can be taken as a plural. In fact, the 12 times that exact phrase is used in Genesis, unto thy seed, those 12 times, the vast majority, are clearly talking about seed, plural. It doesn't have to say the word seeds. You don't have to add the little S on the end. And it's exactly the same in Hebrew, so don't let somebody fool you into thinking you don't understand it because all you know is English. The truth is, it's exactly the same thing. They didn't have to put the plural ending on the word for it to be plural. It's like fish. Fish is plural. It's also singular. You can say fishes, but fish is plenty good for plural. There's lots of fish in the ocean. Right? That's plural. So, when he says seeds, when he says seed, he meant plural. And then Paul comes up with this huge statement saying, notice he didn't say seeds, he said seed, singular. And so, that's the Christ. And so now then the Jews, and this has happened for centuries and centuries, have said,
Look at Paul. What a silly argument. What kind of argument is this from Paul? And they have actually mocked and made fun. All the way through the time of the Reformation, they mocked these words of Paul. Except they should not have. They should have paid attention to what the argument was. You see, Paul is not here trying to prove that Jesus is the Christ, which would not have proved it. Nor is he here trying to prove that every time the word seed is mentioned, it's talking about the Messiah or the promised one or the singular. But what he is saying is that it is used in the singular sometimes. And obviously the time that he's mentioning, he considered it to be singular. Which means the only reason he would have brought that argument up is if the people he were writing to also believed the same way. And I believe we have demonstrated conclusively over the last few weeks that the entire universe of Jews and Samaritans and even Gentiles interpreted the book of Genesis messianically. They believed that a Messiah was coming. And if they believed that a Messiah was coming and they were looking for the clues and looking for the promise, then they had to interpret those promises there about the seed as that. The seed of Christ. Didn't God say, thy seed, his heel, singular? So couldn't Paul say, didn't he say seed in the singular, his heel? Notice, for example, notice Genesis 22. Look at Genesis 22:12. To give you an example of what I'm talking about, to 22:12, and he said, lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him. Notice again, I messed it up. All right. 17. There you go. That in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heaven. Now, is that plural? I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven and as the sand upon the seashore, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his. See, right here in the middle of a promise to a plural descendants of Abraham, he throws in there a promise of that one singular seed. So that you can see, you can actually imagine all of these people with that belief in the Messiah looking at every single word and seeing another clue right here. Read the book of Genesis. And they say, wait, he says, his enemies. And this is another promise about the Messiah. Thy seed, his enemies. So it's not just talking about the plural nation. There's a promise to one person. There's a promise about one person. There are clues being given in every pronouncement about that one person, that singular seed. And of course, Paul's point, which is an absolute valid point, if you recognize that the book of Genesis is promising a Messiah and talking about a singular seed quite often. And it's a perfect point. When Paul is making it, he says, obviously there was a promise given before the law so that the promise cannot be disannulled by the law and this promise cannot be weakened by it. In fact, that promise is preeminent, and that's the point he's making in Galatians. So that when you focus on law and throw out the promise or even overshadow or eclipse the promise, you've made a mistake in how you understood the Old Testament. Which is exactly the problem the Jews had. You see, they got all the way to Deuteronomy and they studied Deuteronomy, but they skipped over those important passages in Genesis. Is it possible that somebody can read the Old Testament and miss the point? Focus on laws. I mean, they will bury themselves in Leviticus. When they got promises of the Messiah all through the Bible. Now you notice this Genesis talking about this seed, and it's, you know, 25, 30 times, I don't know how many times. And so often you see just another little clue. Like right here. He will possess the gate of his enemies. Notice then, for example, 22. I definitely missed something here. All right. Never mind. The one thing I'm trying to point out here about Genesis is that people going from all the time of the patriarchs, before Moses wrote these books, all they had to go on were these pronouncements. All they had to go on were these little clues that God gave. And it makes me wonder why God did it this way, you know, God giving clues and tantalizing hints, making people focus on this person that's coming. And I'm thinking, wow, God is definitely setting it up. He's setting it up slowly. He's saying, all right, I'm going to give a clue here. And this is from the start, from almost the first day, from almost the first page. I'm giving this clue here. Then he tells Abraham, thy seed. And so anybody with any view toward the Messiah would begin looking. Wait. You think he might be talking about the Messiah here? And that's exactly what happened. We have all of these people who were believers even before before the New Testament. And they were looking for hints, clues about the Messiah in every passage of Scripture. You read the Jewish literature before the New Testament and find out how rabidly messianical they were, looking for promises where, you know, someone who's not messianic would not even imagine there'd be a promise there. It's an amazing thing. Another thing I noticed, you might notice several things like this. The promise keeps on narrowing. It's the election. It's where God says, unto thy seed, but which one, you know? There's a whole bunch of us. Well, it gets narrowed down to Abraham because God comes in and says, Abraham, thy seed. Oh, so it's Abraham. We can then knock out Nahor and, you know, and Terah and Lot and all them others. It's not in their seed. It's all narrowing down, beginning to focus. Now it's on Abraham's seed, but not Ishmael, it's Isaac. Doesn't God say, in Isaac shall thy seed. In Isaac shall thy seed be called. Wow! So it's going to be in Isaac. All right? Then he goes a little farther. No, not Esau, but Jacob. Then look at Genesis 49. You'll see another major moment here. A major revelation in Jacob's dying statements. Genesis 49, let's look at verse 8. Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise, thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. Doesn't that sort of sound like one of the promises made earlier about the Messiah? What's going on here? Is it possible God's going to give a clue? Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. When did that happen? I thought that was supposed to happen to Joseph. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? What's he talking about? Can you even imagine somebody reading this and saying, okay, this is like a mystery. What is he trying to say? Then verse 10, the scepter. Anybody know what a scepter is? Isn't that staff, that rod that kings hold? Yes, it is. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. Wow. And unto him shall the gathering of the people be, binding his foal under the vine and his ass's colt under the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes shall be red with wine and his teeth white with milk. I mean, I don't know how this happened. I don't know how it worked out, whether Jacob, you know, saw a vision or whether the Spirit just came upon him or whether Jacob already knew all this stuff, you know, over years of figuring things out. I really don't know, but obviously God is giving a revelation to Jacob at another one of these moments in time. Remember, this is long before the book of Genesis was written. People clinging to these promises. I can just hear the murmuring. I can just hear the talking. I can hear people wondering, what's he saying here? What is he meaning here? But don't you see how God gives more hints and clues? So that almost from the book of Genesis, you see almost the full picture of what's going to be happening. The Messiah is going to reign. He's going to be a child of Judah. Once again, the narrowing down, that election. The tantalizing hints coming out. the all nations included, and the last days. And then notice that word Shiloh. Now the word Shiloh simply means tranquility or rest. I mean, that's what the word means. And so people, well, what does it mean, Shiloh? We're talking about Shiloh. But notice how he says, until Shiloh come. He's not talking about the place over there in the promised land where they put the ark for a long time. It's not talking, it says, until Shiloh come. And then notice it says, and unto him. So Shiloh is a person. So now we have an actual calling, a name, a terminology being developed about this person that's coming, the Shiloh. This Shiloh is coming. And if it's a person and the word means rest, then it means rest giver or prince of peace or prosperity or you name it. This is what God was giving to people before He gave them the book of Genesis. He was giving them hope. He was giving them something to look forward to and believe in. Something to cling to. Something to dig and look for. Way before there was a book of Genesis, before there was a Deuteronomy, before there was a Daniel, before there were Psalms, long before a New Testament, they were looking forward to somebody coming that's going to reign, and He's going to be from Judah. And wow, this time is going to be some time. Well, now we look much later on and we can come up with all kinds of things about washing His garments and wine and what have you, but back then I'm not sure what that meant to them or what they were thinking. Obviously, though, God was giving clues. This mystery revealed slowly, progressively, and it became a consistent focus of the believers. Not of everybody, but of the believers, a consistent focus looking for that someone, that promised elect king that was coming. All right. We're going to move on now. Numbers chapter 23. This is an amazing thing as well. That Balaam prophesied, trying his best to curse Israel. He couldn't pull it off. I mean, Balak the king was offering him all kinds of money. Going to get him rich. And Balaam was, you know, salivating at all that money. And boy, did he want it. All he had to do was curse Israel. And every time he opened his mouth, the Spirit of the Lord would come on him and he would bless Israel. And Balak is getting irritated. These three times I've told you to curse them and I'm willing to pay you if you will, and you won't do it. I don't understand what's going on. But right in the middle of all this prophesying, blessing Israel, you notice some things. Like chapter 23, verse 21. Balaam says, He that is God hath not beheld iniquity in Jacob. Which is a wow, that's a big thing. Neither hath he seen perverseness in Israel. The Lord his God is with him. And the shout of a king is among them. What do you mean the shout of a king is among them? There was no king. They didn't have a king. God brought them out of Egypt. Where's the shout of the king? Why didn't he throw that in there? Well, people knew about this king that's coming. I mean, they knew that this Shiloh was a king. He's going to carry a scepter. They already were putting it all together, piecing the puzzle together. They had a very wide and good understanding of what was going on. Look at chapter 24, verse 7. He shall pour the water out of his buckets, and his seed, did he say seed? And his seed shall be in many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Okay, a king is coming, and he's got a kingdom, and this kingdom's going to be exalted. And wasn't he called Shiloh? Yep, he's the Prince of Peace, even before he was prophesied as the Prince of Peace. Notice then some familiarity that this Balaam had with Genesis. Look at verse 9. 24, verse 9, says, He couched, he lay down as a lion and as a great lion, who shall stir him? Didn't Jacob say that over there in Genesis 49? Said those same things. How did Balaam get that in his mouth? And look a little bit farther, he says, Blessed is he that blesseth thee, and cursed is he that curseth thee. Didn't God say that to Abraham? Yeah, God said that to Abraham, you know, centuries before. Here Balaam is, you know, in the midst of a prophetic utterance, and he says that again. Wow, is he familiar with Genesis or what's going on? And look at chapter 24, verse 17. This is Balaam talking, I shall see him, but not now. I shall behold him, but not nigh. In other words, it's going to come later. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab and destroy all the children of Sheph. Okay, now we have a prophetic utterance from God giving more clues as to this one that's coming right in the middle of all this other stuff that's happening. That is, right in the middle of Sinai. Right in the middle of, you know, the wandering in the desert. Right in the middle of the plagues coming out of Egypt, God starts talking about, when God comes down and starts revealing things, He starts talking about this kingdom that's going to be exalted, and this scepter, and this king that's higher than Agag, and all of these things, and it's coming out of the mouth of Balaam. And I wonder, well, how do they know this? Well, they took over, they conquered Balaam later on, they killed him, and they got his records, I assume, and Moses put it right in his book. He said, hey, this is important stuff. Let's put this down in the book so we know it forever. Balaam prophesied about the Christ. I don't know much about Balaam. I'm not sure whether he was a genuine prophet or God just, you know, used him even as a false prophet. I really don't understand that. And I know that he was greedy and that he tried to curse and kept on trying and God got angry with him. And I know the children of Israel killed him because he was bad news. Still, he prophesied about the Christ right there in Numbers. Now look at Deuteronomy 18:15. You can see how someone, even expecting the Messiah, might get confused, though. You can see if they did not know what we know now, how they might be confused as to who it's talking about and why they might be expecting more people. This is another example of that. Look at Deuteronomy 18. Look at verse 15. The Lord thy God will raise up unto thee a prophet from the midst of thee, of thy brethren, like unto me. Unto him you shall hearken. Look at verse 18. I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, like unto thee. And I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I shall command them. And it shall come to pass that whosoever will not hearken unto my words, which he shall speak in my name, I will require it of him. Moses, in the middle of his situation that he had with the children of Israel, begins giving another promise about a prophet that's going to come like Moses. Anybody who had a mind to think about the promised coming, the king that's coming, could not help but think, well, you know, is this the same person? And obviously, many people did. And yet some people were confused. One thing that we see here is that he's coming as a prophet. And as the prophet, he's going to be like Moses. Well, like Moses, what does that mean? Moses was a special prophet. Moses wasn't like any. In fact, God makes a very clear point saying, Moses is not like all those other prophets. Moses is a prophet, the kind of prophet that I speak to face to face. I mean, if I'm going to talk to another prophet, I send him a dream. Or, you know, I'll speak to him in whispers and mysteries, and he'll prophesy that way. But not Moses. Moses, we talk together like friends. He sits here in my presence. He's seen me face to face. We have conversations. That's like Moses. And then in the end of Deuteronomy, Doesn't the editor of Deuteronomy get to then say, you know, no prophet arose like Moses. None like Moses. None have happened like Moses. Well, what's he keep mentioning that for? Obviously, somebody was messianic saying, nope, hadn't happened yet. Not like Moses. There's a prophet coming. Like Moses, he's going to be so special, he'll speak to God face to face, like Moses, but he'll be greater than Moses. He'll be more than Moses. Even as a prophet, I can just see anybody with the hope of that coming deliverer would grasp these promises and begin to add to their understanding of it. Now notice 1 Samuel chapter 2. 1 Samuel chapter 2. Look at verse 10. Hannah was given a baby miraculously, and was praising God for it. Beautiful, beautiful praise, beautiful prayer.
But look at verse 10. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Out of heaven shall He thunder upon them. The Lord shall judge the ends of the earth, and He shall give strength unto His king and exalt the horn of His anointed. All right, obviously they're expecting a king. This is what the people who are expecting the Christ are expecting. They're expecting a king. But notice this is the first time He's called His anointed. If you want to know how to discern whether it's talking about His anointed, the Christ, the Messiah, just about always when it talks about a possessive like His anointed, thine anointed, the anointed, something of that nature, it's talking about the Christ. It's talking about the Messiah. It is a promise. Here He says, He shall exalt the horn of His anointed. This king that's coming is called the anointed. Now notice, this Hannah, she does not have, you know, the books of Daniel and the Psalms. All she has is, you know, the books of Moses and possibly Joshua and Judges or, you know, some of those writings. But she calls Him the anointed, and this is the first time. And it makes me think that at the time of Hannah, which is the time of Samuel, Samuel was born from Hannah, and from Samuel on, that's when the transition came from being ruled by judges to being ruled by kings. It's obvious to me that there was a national conversation going on about a king. You know, I mean, we're waiting for a king. We're hoping for a king. How would we do a king? And so this is part of the conversation. The reason why I say that is because another person comes on later on. Look at chapter 2, verse 35. And this is the prophet that came to denounce Eli. I will raise me up a faithful priest that shall do according to that which is in mine heart and in my mind, and I will build him a sure house. And he shall walk before mine anointed forever. Two people in the same, you know, week or so calling this person that they're expecting the anointed. So in my mind, Hannah didn't just coin the phrase. It's obviously between the time of Moses and this time now, they have developed the terminology even farther, and now they're calling Him the anointed, that one that's coming, that Shiloh, that one that we're waiting for. And notice that He's not called here a priest. He says, I will raise me up a faithful priest. That's talking about Samuel. Now, He's raising Him up a faithful priest that's going to do these things, and he, Samuel, is going to walk before my anointed, the king, forever. Wow! How can Samuel walk before Him forever? That doesn't include the possibility of maybe a resurrection from the dead. Anybody who's looking for the truth would see it there. They would see some things. They obviously took the promises seriously. They could see all sorts of things happening. Notice then Job chapter 19. I really don't know how to place Job. I like to do this progressively. And I don't really know where Job fits in. I mean, maybe Job is before Moses. There are a lot of reasons to think that the book of Job was written before Moses wrote even the book of Genesis. And one of the reasons why is because what you find in the book of Job and how many references are made never to Sinai, never to the covenant, never to the law, never to any of those things that happened, but always references to the flood, to the creation, to the general truth about God. So it makes you think this is a very primitive book. This is a book before all these other revelations. And yet there's other things, especially this one I'm going to read you, chapter 19, look at verse 25. That makes you think, wow, these people knew something. Look at verse 25, for I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that He shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God. That's almost New Testament theology there. Talking about, you know, resurrection. We're talking about the latter day and the Redeemer's going to stand upon the earth. And He called Him His Redeemer. My Redeemer liveth. He's alive at this moment. The preexistence of the Christ. Wow! I don't know where to fit it. I'm pretty sure Job is a very ancient book. It's not modern. So how did they know these things about the Christ except they were intent on finding out about Him? They wanted to know about the Christ. And several times Job mentions
you know, the need for a ransom and the need for a Savior and salvation, personal salvation, my Redeemer, last day, resurrection, beautiful things, amazing. Now then, we get to another chunk of history, which is the monarchy. After Samuel comes Saul, then David, and man, you talk about an explosion of understanding about the Christ, the Messiah, starting with David. Look at 1 Chronicles chapter 17, verse 11. 1 Chronicles chapter 17, verse 11. Nathan was told to go talk to David. David was wanting to build a temple. God wouldn't let him. It says though, 1 Chronicles 17:11, "And it shall come to pass, when thy days be expired, that thou must go to be with thy fathers, that I will raise up thy seed after thee." Did he say seed? My goodness. "Which shall be of thy sons. And I will establish his kingdom." Just like Balaam had said. "And he shall build me an house." He shall build me a house. I don't think he's talking about Solomon here. "He shall build me a house, and I will establish his throne forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. And I will not take my mercy away from him, as I took it from him that was before thee. But I will settle him in mine house and in my kingdom forever, and his throne shall be established forevermore." Now, if you're a believer, you believe in the promise that God has made from the time He spoke to Eve and the serpent, and the time He spoke to Abraham, and then to Isaac, and then to Jacob, and then to Judah, and then to Moses, and then to Balaam, and how many times He keeps mentioning it, and how much they had developed. All of these believers listen to this statement, and they know something. All right, it's been narrowed down farther. The election is becoming even closer. Now we know it's going to be one of the sons of David, and that's where the king is going to come from. And this one is going to be established with a kingdom forever. Wow, this is one of the big movements in the progressive revelation where God begins to say, "I'm going to give a whole lot of information now about this Messiah coming, because he's going to be David's seed, and he's going to have that eternal kingdom." Look at Psalms chapter... Well, let's look at Psalm 22. I'll get out of order a little bit because I want to keep it in chronological order as best I can. I'm going to have to quit pretty quick here. Look at Psalms 22. This is a messianic psalm. You really want to get into understanding the Christ and what was prophesied and how important it was in the Old Testament. You get into the Psalms. Just read through the Psalms and you'll see it. Look at verse 1 just to show this is a messianic psalm. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? That's what Jesus said on the cross. Look at verse 27. All the ends of the world shall remember and turn unto the Lord. And all the kindreds of the nations shall worship before thee. All nations. Here we have that same theme. For the kingdom is the Lord's. It's whose? The Lord's. Whenever you see the word Lord in all capitals, that's the word Jehovah. So it's very definitely talking about God. The kingdom is the Lord's, and He is the governor among the nations. Wait a minute. Doesn't this seem like a huge step forward in our understanding of who this Christ is going to be? Son of David? But then didn't God say, "He shall be my son"? He did say that over there when he talked to David. He says, "He's going to be a son of David, of thy sons." But then he says, "He shall be my son." God said that. Well, now he says, "The kingdom is the Lord's. He is the governor among the nations." Whoa, what's going on here? It begins to become more and more. Look at chapter 24, verse 7. "Lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be ye lift up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in." Remember, the believers have been waiting for the King of glory to come. This has been their focus. All the believers saying, "The King of glory, come on, we're waiting for this King of glory." He says, "Who is this King of glory?" Yes, tell us, who is this King of glory? Who is the Messiah? Who is the Christ that's coming? The Lord. All capitals, that's Jehovah. Jehovah God. The Lord, strong and mighty. The Lord, mighty in battle. Who is this King of glory? Verse 10. The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory. Now, if you're just randomly, you know, going through the Bible, you know, just trying to get a blessing, maybe you wouldn't have noticed it. But anybody who was looking for the Messiah and sees the progressive revelation coming on could not miss it. Who is this King of glory that's coming? Who is the one that's coming? Who is going to reign? Who is going to be over all the nations? How are all the nations going to be blessed? Who is the King of glory? It's Jehovah God. Is that possible? This was David's time. These are Psalms in David's time. Look at Psalms 110. All right, I'm going to have to quit pretty quick here. So we'll get to a stopping place. Psalms 110. Look at verse 1. The Lord said unto my Lord. Notice that. The Lord, all capitals, the Lord, Jehovah, said unto my Lord. Not all capitals, meaning the Lord of whoever's writing this psalm, Psalm of David. The Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. The Lord shall send the rod of thy strength out of Zion. Rule thou in the midst of thine enemies. This same repetitive theme, thine enemies, rule, king, scepter, all these things, repeating the same thing. Everyone who was hoping for the Christ recognized this as a messianic promise from the moment he said these type of things. Notice another tendency that begins in these Psalms and goes all the way through all the prophets, in that the Christ, the Messiah, is constantly referred to as some extension of God Himself, such as His rod, or the arm of His strength, or some other extension of Himself. So that quite often it looks like it's talking about Jehovah's body is going to reign on earth. Wow. Okay, I'm going to stop right there. We got some Psalms that come later. Go a little bit farther, then we'll deal next week with the prophecies, some prophecies. There's no way we're going to touch all of them. And I'm not trying to touch all the prophecies that identify the Christ. I'm just trying to touch on the ones that show Him revealed directly. And then if we were to get into types, we'd never end. Okay, next week.